This is an ABC podcast.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Good afternoon. Welcome to The Country Hour. I'm Cassie Huff with you today. Now, South Australia isn't a big lot feeding state, but you might be interested to know that the number of cattle on feed in Australia is now higher than at any other time in history. There's 1.3 million head in feed lots at the moment. Amazing, considering the country is not even experiencing a widespread drought.
No longer is our business model about, you know, we fill up when there's droughts and we empty out when there's flooding rains or rains come and pastures grow. So I think it's about the lot feeding sector is a sophisticated part of the beef supply chain.
I'll have more on what's driving that soon. But first up today, we'll head to the Eyre Peninsula, where administrators will liquidate a Port Lincoln agriculture machinery business after the company went into voluntary administration in March. Moose Industries owes 40 creditors about $200,000. Managing partner of Oracle Insolvency Services, Nick Cooper, says they're working on getting as much money back to creditors as possible.
So the company was previously under voluntary administration, and at a creditors meeting held last week, creditors voted to put the company into liquidation. So my job now is, as the liquidator of the company, is to maximise the price that I can get for the business and the assets, and hopefully have a decent return to the unsecured creditors.
Now, we first talked probably, you know, between 8 to 12 weeks ago, and there was the hope that, you know, when you guys took over effectively the business, there was a hope that you would keep it trading for a period of time and try and get these orders that have been placed out to those people. How has that gone between now or between then and now?
Yes, we have kept the doors open and have been trading the business, albeit at a limited extent to what it was previously. So we've been reasonably successful at that. We've probably completed probably about 25% of the orders that we had on the books at the time. We've had a few difficulties with supply of materials and labour, but notwithstanding those difficulties, we've managed to get a few of the orders done, which is encouraging.
And what does that mean for the other 75% now?
Yeah, so the other orders that we weren't able to complete, unfortunately, those individuals and businesses where they've paid a deposit for their goods, they'll unfortunately become the unsecured creditors of the company, and they'll have to unfortunately wait to see if we can get a reasonable price for the assets and make a distribution in the liquidation.
And, you know, since kind of, you know, being involved with the business, were there any more kind of creditors that were found? Because I think when we first spoke, there was around, you know, 10 to 12 deposits had been paid. Were there any more uncovered, you know, since taking over the running?
Yes, there were. So the when we were first appointed, we identified from the company's jobs register, there was about 10 or 12, some major, so to speak, orders that were on the books to be made. There were quite a few others that we did find, but they were much smaller jobs. So in total, the number of jobs, both the big ones and the small ones, were around about 40.
What's the time frame now? You know, as you said, you guys are trying to sell off, you know, some equipment and things like that and get a good price for that. Is there a time frame in doing so to try and get some of the money back to those creditors?
Well, yes, there is. We're still hopeful that we can sell the business as a going concern. We did go through a marketing campaign and had a number of expressions of interest to purchase the business. Many of those expressions of interest have now fallen away, but we are still dealing with one final party, and it's possible that we can do a deal to sell the business as a going concern if this one party is still interested. If not, then we would be calling in an auctioneer to sell the equipment and stock by way of a public auction.
So there is still a chance that someone or a group of people may still buy the business?
That's right, yes, there is. Yeah, there's one party that we're currently negotiating with.
And how are the current owners or the former owners going? Have you been in touch with them constantly?
Yes, I am. The director of the company is still actively involved in working in the business, so he's certainly is assisting us with completion of the orders. So yes, so they are actively involved. Yeah.
Probably more of an overview of the current market and the current climate that we're in, are we seeing more and more businesses going into voluntary administration, you know, over the past couple of years?
Yes, we are. It's been an interesting time in terms of insolvency works. Insolvency has actually fallen during the COVID pandemic period. I think a lot of that's because of the government incentives such as JobKeeper, which were very useful and much welcomed by many businesses, that the procedures in place managed to keep a lot of businesses afloat, which might have otherwise fallen into insolvency. But now that those incentives have lapsed or expired, we are now seeing a small rise in insolvencies as the effects of the financial pressures from all sides.
Yeah, and do you think that there could be more down the track, even though that we are coming out of COVID, there still could be some problems for small businesses down the track?
Yes, certainly. For a variety of reasons. Obviously, there was an interest rate rise recently and there might be more on the cards, so that will affect some businesses. A lot of businesses that we're speaking to at the moment, they're either having problems in sourcing materials or more currently at the moment is just labour. They're saying that a lot of businesses have labour shortages because of the COVID pandemic and people catching COVID and not being able to work.
And just finally, I assume that the priority at this stage is, trying to reimburse those creditors as much as possible?
Yes, it is. That's right. That's why we're hopeful that we can either sell the business as a going concern for a reasonable price, or if not, we can sell it by way of an auction and still get a very good price that way.
Managing Partner of Oracle Insolvency Services, Nick Cooper, speaking with Dylan Smith. Australia's lot feeding sector has broken two records in the first quarter of 2022. The first record is the number of cattle on feed is now higher than any other time in history, with 1.3 million head of cattle in feedlots across the country. Remarkable, given the good season in many parts of this country. The second record is the industry's capacity, or the amount of cattle allowed to be put into feedlots, is now at 1.5 million head, almost 1.5 million head. That's an increase of just over 32,000 head on the previous record in 2019, when Australia was in the middle of its worst drought. Barb Madden is the president of the Australian Lot Feeders Association. She says the numbers show the level of investment and confidence in the industry.
So we've seen just steady increase again coming out of the back of the December quarter and into the March 2022 quarter. Continual rise of cattle numbers on feed. We're up to 1.269 million on feed nationally around the country. And also in the first quarter of 2022, we've got record capacity numbers. So that's now up to 1.485 million. So around the nation, we've got feedlots that are occupying almost 85% of that total capacity. So really positive, very strong numbers for the lot feeding industry.
Can you just explain that term capacity numbers there? Because that's not actual head on the ground, is it? That's just the potential.
That's infrastructure, yes. So the ability to be able to put cattle into those feedlots on the ground. So that's the total number that can be on feed in the country at the moment. That's that 1.485. And at the moment, the number of cattle on feed is the 1.269. So that's where we're getting that 85% utilisation of that total capacity.
And which state is leading the way in terms of the actual growth of the feedlot industry we've seen just in this first quarter?
Across the country, we're seeing steady increases across all states. So that's New South Wales, Victoria, Queensland, South Australia and Western Australia. So really positive growth in all states. Overall, in total numbers on feed, Queensland is the number one, followed by New South Wales. But now Western Australia is coming into the third position there on the back of these figures. So WA is certainly, highlighting to us that, as I said before, lot feeding is becoming an integral part of the beef supply chain and we're here to stay.
And, I mean, that growth is there despite the fact that the price of cattle is incredible at the moment. But, there's also concern about, I guess, grain stocks around the world and the price of grain going forward.
Yes, you know, the beginning of 20, well, in Queensland and New South Wales, we've had significant weather events. And I was going to say in the beginning of 2022, there's, you know, COVID impacts across the state. Well, they've been ongoing for a number of, you know, the last couple of years. We've got the war in Ukraine. We've got supply chain logistics. So there's a number of global issues that are impacting all of our industries around the country. And so the lot feeding sector is, it isn't immune from that. But yes, since this March quarter, we are seeing rises in grain prices. So obviously lot feeders are very acutely aware of that and monitoring that very closely. So with high cattle prices, high grain prices, margins are thin, but that's also what the lot feeding industry does. We measure everything that we do, you know, we've got cattle coming and going every single day, and so are the commodities. So it's the logistics of running a lot feeding business every single day. So high grain prices are definitely something that we're all acutely aware of and keeping a very close eye on.
So what does it say about the future then, Barb, just to wrap up for us, because we've got these two records in the first quarter. It's the number of cattle on feed and it's the industry capacity. What does that say about the future of the sector?
The future of the sector is very bright. Yeah, no longer is our business model about, you know, we fill up when there's droughts and we empty out when there's flooding rains or rains come and pastures grow. So I think it's about the lot feeding sector is a sophisticated part of the beef supply chain, and we produce high quality grain fed beef consistently every single day. And I think there is confidence in our international and domestic markets that they want our product. So I can only see positive times ahead for the lot feeding industry.
Those margins would be pretty tight, I can imagine, at the moment with the price of cattle and the price of feed. Barb Madden is the president of the Australian Lot Feeders Association, and she was speaking with Belinda Farish-Getty. I'm Cassie Huff. You're listening to The Country Hour across South Australia and Broken Hill. It is 16 minutes past 12.
Learn how to wrangle unruly chooks in the latest issue of ABC Gardening Australia magazine. Invite the birds in with big colourful grevilleas, grow easy care ferns and stop the rot in pawpaw. And in ABC Organic Gardener, see how to create a wildlife haven, have success with citrus and explore leafy greens that grow happily in the shade. Gardening Australia and Organic Gardener magazines. Available from newsagents and abcmagazines.com.au.
You're listening to Cassie Huff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
We're going to get to the weather next, and I'm sure there's a lot of people eagerly anticipating what is in store, given there is a bit of a system that's starting to make its way across South Australia. It seems like winter is going to hit this state with a bit of a rush soon. But in the meantime, in the Barossa and Eden Valley, water security and access to enough water continues to be of concern. The Department of Environment and Water is putting together a plan for the future, and it wants the community to be involved. Demetria Panagiotou Harris spoke with Ashley Kingsborough from the DEW, about how serious the situation is.
So water availability is a critical concern for all, particularly in the viticulture sector in the Barossa at the moment. As the climate changes and demands for grapes grow into the future, our analysis shows that there is likely to be a long-term shortfall in water availability. And so what this strategy is really trying to do is to explore those different possible and plausible futures and identify where we can have strategic interventions that will ensure that those water shortfalls don't actually eventuate. So that might include changing the way water is delivered to the region from the River Murray or from alternative sources such as recycled water.
And what kind of effects does low water availability have on the region?
So the agricultural production from the Barossa is highly dependent on water availability. So in years of low water availability, it typically results in lower yields from existing vineyards. So being able to secure additional and long-term water supplies for the region is of critical importance to the ongoing economic viability of the region.
What are the key elements of the strategy?
So the strategy looks to set out six pillars within it, and they are its key elements. And so particularly it focuses on the integrated supply and demand management. Also looking at regenerative land management and how that can affect water availability, having a focus on healthy waterways and ensuring that the water-dependent ecosystems in the region continue to thrive. It also looks at business innovation and diversification and how that can contribute in a changing future. And there's also a key element in relation to education and knowledge management, and so how we can bring the best and brightest minds to address these challenges in the Barossa. And it also speaks to the fact that we need to work together. So there's an element in and around governance and how institutions and individuals can help contribute to better outcomes into the future.
The strategy will be discussed at Australia's Green Wine Sustainability event at the Barossa Cellar next Thursday, the 26th of May. What's happening there and how can people get involved?
So the Barossa Australia are hosting the Green Wine Sustainability event on the 26th of May, as you point out. Yes, so there's still places available to attend that event, and that will be a broader community discussion around sustainability in the wine industry, particularly in Australia.
Community members have been involved already, but you're calling upon them to provide more feedback on the draft. How important is it to have their views reflected in the strategy?
Yeah, so that's critically important for the credibility of the strategy overall. So fortunately, the process of developing the strategy to date has very much been one of co-development with a number of organisations, including Barossa Infrastructure Limited, Barossa Australia, the relevant local councils and the Regional Development Authority, as well as representatives from state government. It's also had really, really strong input from a number of individual grape growers and wine businesses. So, but what we want to be able to do now is to share this with a broader audience to get, I guess, to see if the messages within there resonate with them and if they think they're appropriate around securing the long-term water security for the Barossa.
Moving forward, what is the next step in the process?
So we will undertake a consultation period now over the next 2 months. And during that period, we will look to integrate any feedback we receive from people into the final document itself. And then we'll look forward to, I guess, publishing a final version of this strategy and then moving on into an implementation phase later in this year. So I'd really encourage people to have a read of the strategy. It's not a long document. And if there is further interest, there's lots of background and supporting materials as well. And then me and my team are very happy to take any questions or queries that people may have.
Department of Environment and Waters Ashley Kingsborough speaking with Demetria Panagiotaris. And we'll keep following that issue. It's certainly been going for a long time, but there are big concerns. And while it's not super wet at the moment, there is hope that there will be some water on the way. But regardless, that area is still looking for a lot more water security. But speaking of what hopefully will be coming across the state in the next week or so, we'll head across to the Bureau of Meteorology now, where I'm joined by Senior Forecaster Tina Donaldson. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Kathy.
It seems like winter is going to arrive with a bit of a bang. When's winter? Start of winter is next Wednesday. But in the meantime, there's still quite a lot of weather on the way as well. What's happening?
Yeah, that's right, Kathy. So there's two systems that we're keeping our eye on. So there's one that's currently moving over the West Coast District as we speak, and that will bring an area of showers and some thunderstorms for most parts over today and the next couple of days. But then later on the weekend into early next week, there's a more significant cold front moving through as well that will see further rainfall and temperatures drop as well. And so that's when I think we'll really see winter come in with a bang. But looking at today, and we'll start off with the flood warning that's been issued for inland rivers, and that's for flooding that's currently occurring along the Diamantina River. So that's still current with the potential for river flooding along the Diamantina River between Birdsville and the Goyta Lagoons. So that's still ongoing now. But looking to the current satellite and radar picture, the back edge of the showers sort of between Ceduna and Nullarbor at the moment, and a few thunderstorms in that area as well. So rainfall that we've had so far, not too many rainfall locations out there, but up to 9 a.m. this morning, Nullarbor had about 5 millimetres of rain, and still ticking along with the showers now continuing to move over Ceduna. I think just 0.5 millimetre there at the moment, but expecting more today. So the forecast for the remainder of today is for a very high chance of showers across the west, and there's also a chance of thunderstorms or also across western parts today as well. And small chance that we could see some heavier falls with any of those embedded thunderstorms and also some gusty winds. Also a slight to medium chance of showers extending into the central districts later this afternoon and this evening with that trough just slowly progressing east and then remaining dry in the east for today. Looking ahead to tomorrow, so that trough sort of sitting over Western Eyre Peninsula and then just slowly continuing to track east. So again, a very high chance of showers over the agricultural area tomorrow, but they're easing as you head further north away from the low that's connected to that trough. So a slight to medium chance further north. Still possible thunderstorms over most parts of the agricultural area tomorrow, also parts of the west coast, mainly in the morning, but then sort of extending eastwards during the day to areas basically south of Cooper Pedy to Broken Hill. Still remaining relatively mild to warm with those northerly winds ahead of that trough, but then they'll start to tend more moderate to fresh north to northwesterly ahead of that trough, then shift west to southwesterly from the west as that moves through. Then on Thursday, looks like the trough will clear the east of the state in the early morning, but still a very high chance of showers persisting across the southern agricultural area in the wake of that trough, and then a slight medium chance further north. A little bit cooler in the wake of that cold front there, so cool to mild temperatures, and the wind starting to ease back as well. So light to moderate northwest to southwesterly winds there on the Thursday, and then to on to Friday, we start to see a high pressure system move in from the west, but there is just another low pressure trough moving over the southeast on the Friday, keeping a high chance of showers down there. So high chance of showers mainly in the lower southeast, but a slight to medium chance across other parts of the southern agricultural area and the west coast district as well. And then also just a slight chance lingering on in the northeast pastoral in the passage of that as that front sort of just continues to move east. And again, cool to mild in the wake of that trough as well, and wind starting to ease back with that new high pressure system moving in from the west. So in terms of rainfall, sort of basically from that trough system moving through, we're expecting around 1 to 5 millimetres, generally speaking, and then increasing to 5 to 15 millimetres across the agricultural area, increasing further to 15 to 30 millimetres across the west coast district and the south of the northwest pastoral. And then there is a chance that we could see some heavier isolated falls of around 30 to 50 millimetres, mainly with thunderstorms, and that would be mainly today west of about, say, Streaky Bay, with any sort of thunderstorms that form up through that way. Then looking onto the outlook period, it looks like showers sort of continuing on across the agricultural area there on the Saturday. But then it looks like some point later on the weekend, there will be a more significant cold front that moves across the state there. Still some uncertainty regarding the timing of this front, but certainly temperatures dropping down, more into the mid to low teens on Sunday and Monday in the wake of that cold front. And we'll see a re-intensification of showers on the Sunday and the Monday, and then continuing on into the Tuesday there again with the passage of that more significant cold front. But yeah, like I said, still just some uncertainty with that in the longer term, but certainly in the short term, the main focus of the rain in the west today, extending into central and eastern parts on Wednesday and Thursday, Cassie.
Right. Well, it's even if the rainfall isn't certain, the drop in temperature seems pretty certain. Monday is looking very cold, the coldest day of the year by the looks of things.
Yes, most likely it will be for many parts. But, winter just around the corner now, so yes. I suppose to be expected. We've had a good run of late, that's for sure.
It's been really rather warm. This 5 to 15 millimetres that you're expecting across the agricultural area, where is that but going to extend to? Because I know the southeast in particular hasn't received much of the rain that's been coming across.
Yeah, that's right. They have been running below average of recent times, but it does look like that they will be included in these higher rainfall totals as well. And then again on the Friday, there's an extra little trough that moves across the southeast on the Friday, so the southeast should see some rainfall from this system. They shouldn't miss out.
I think a lot of places are crying out for rain, so hopefully the upper end of the forecasting range is received by those who are looking for it. Thank you so much for your time today.
Not a problem. Thank you.
Tina Donaldson from the Bureau of Meteorology there in the far west of New South Wales. They're not missing out. Seems like there's a bit of weather around tomorrow there as well. It'll be cloudy in the upper western. There's a medium chance of showers most likely from late morning. There is the possibility of a thunderstorm in the far west in the late morning as well. Winds will pick up a little. Overnight temperatures will fall to between 9 and 14 degrees, but the daytime temperatures will reach the low 20s. The lower western will be partly cloudy and there's a high chance of showers in the west, a medium chance elsewhere, and the chance of a thunderstorm in the west from late morning as well. Overnight there is going to drop to between 7 and 12 degrees, but the daytime temperatures will reach about 20 degrees. So the cold front hasn't quite hit yet, but certainly bracing for it. More to come on the Country Hour as it is coming up at 12:30.
You're listening to the Country Hour. For more stories from across the country, go to abc.net.au/rural. On ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill, this is Cassie Huff. Cassie Huff.
Hello, I'm very glad you could join me this afternoon. We are expecting an announcement out of the state government this afternoon after the Emergency Management Council meeting today. We'll let you know what's happening there. And you may or may not be aware, with China no longer buying as much wine, many of the storages in the Riverland are full. And given it's the largest producing region in the country, the industry is keen to find out just how bad the situation is.
It's up to the industry to come together and actually measure and audit the magnitude of the problem. We can't just throw a solution at a problem that we don't know exactly what it is.
I'll have more on the tough conditions grape growers are facing at the moment. That's coming up next. But first, we have to find out what's making news with Emma Ribellato. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Cassie. SA health authorities have revealed 14 more people with COVID have died, including a man in his 30s. These deaths happened between March and May. Another 3,482 people have tested positive to the virus. Well, as you just mentioned, we're about to find out if the mask mandate in high schools will be dropped. The state's Emergency Management Council has been meeting this morning to talk about the rule, as well as how much longer the Police Commissioner Grant Stevens will stay in charge of COVID rules in SA. The Premier and others are about to speak to the media. The new Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, has made his first international speech since being sworn in. He's in Tokyo for the Quad Leaders Summit alongside leaders of the US, Japan and India. Mr Albanese says even though there's been a change of government, Australia's commitment to the alliance remains strong, and he's highlighted a more ambitious approach on climate change. And the holiday rental firm Airbnb is suspending its domestic business in China. China has some of the world's toughest COVID restrictions, and the lockdowns there are showing no signs of ending, making travel very difficult. We'll have more news at 1.
Thanks for that. Emma Ribellato there. Now, as I was just saying, prices for grapes, red wine grapes in particular, continue to decline amid China's tariffs. And the future of the industry is a bit shaky. Storage at many wineries is full and some growers are taking stock, while others are even considering calling it quits. Eliza Berlow has just taken a look at the issue.
Too much wine sounds like a strange problem, but in Australia's major wine grape producing regions, an oversupply of fruit paired with a price drop is creating a disastrous situation. It's especially dire in South Australia's Riverland, where 80% of the wine produced is exported. Member for Chafee Tim Whetstone says there needs to be an audit into how many wine grapes have been left on vines.
First and foremost, we need to understand the magnitude of the problem. If we have got fruit that is still hanging on trellis and does not have contract or does not have a home, we need to, I guess, accurately assess what amount of fruit is out there and what can be done with it. If we don't have tank storage for wine, do we have the will to distillate some of that fruit? Do we have the ability to have some level of subsidy to shake that fruit onto the ground?
Across the border, growers are calling for government assistance after an estimated 20,000 tonnes of fruit were left unsold in the Murray Valley. Mr Whetstone says South Australia needs to take stock of its uncontracted fruit to plan for the next few years.
You know, we can't let the wine industry continue to be put under this pressure, because the viability of the wine industry, particularly in the Riverland, the engine room of the wine industry nationally, it needs to have some level of viability, particularly through these tough times.
Whose responsibility is it?
I think it's up to the industry to come together and actually measure and audit the magnitude of the problem. We can't just throw a solution at a problem that we don't know exactly what it is. I do know of some vineyards that do have fruit still hanging, and that needs to be addressed. But we don't know what we're trying to fix if we don't know how much fruit is out there hanging on the vine.
Member for Chaffey, Tim Whetstone. CCW Chief Executive Mr Godden says all contracted grapes from cooperative members has been sent to customers, but that he didn't have data on how much fruit is uncontracted.
We have at CCW quite a good standing, long-standing arrangement, but I would say that most growers evaluate their position at the end of a growing season, and that would be as part of the normal cycle. You will have vines coming to end of life, those sort of decisions. You'll look at out of favour varieties and changing them over and what that pattern looks like. And so, you know, that generally does occur through this point in time.
He says CCW is gathering information to help its members assess the viability of their vineyards.
You know, we always advocate on being working for the grower is that the more information we can hear from the markets, from the wineries, at the soonest allows our growers to make the decisions that need to be made. And certainly we will be seeking that on behalf of our members over the next month and then providing that so that, that they can make those decisions.
CCW Chief Executive Jim Godden. Industry body Australian Grape and Wine says it expects the difficult commercial conditions to continue for the next 3 to 5 years. It's a sobering situation for the more than 900 growers in the Riverland, with some simply choosing to get out of the game. Real estate agent Sam Hayes from Toop and Toop Rural says several vineyards in the region have been listed recently.
Vineyards like these vineyards that we're selling in Barmer and Cobdogla, you know, go from back into more local hands as well. So we're getting a lot of interest just in the first couple of days from neighbours and people in the local area looking to buy back vineyards that they once owned.
While the initial interest has been from local buyers, Mr Hayes says it could attract wider investment.
You look at housing prices in the Greater Adelaide region and then you compare, you know, you can buy a vineyard and get a house thrown in for free almost at the moment in the Riverland, the way it's looking over the next 6 months. And that's very attractive for someone coming out of Adelaide. And in 2 years' time, I think people will look back on what they've paid for a property in Barmer or Cobdogla or Renmark, and especially the vineyard, what is currently a liability, will be an asset very soon again.
Sam Hayes from Toop and Toop Rural, ending that story by Eliza Burlage. And a caller, Mark, has called in from Adelaide to suggest maybe this excess wine could be turned into red or white wine vinegar. They do it in Europe. It is possibly an idea. Thanks so much for the call. I don't know how much vinegar production or how much it's worth, whether it is worth it, but, I mean, surely it's better than tipping it down the drain. But it's something to look at. Thanks so much for that call. Now, I'm sure most people are well on truly over the election, but it has thrown up some interesting results. There's been some suggestion that the election has shown the divide between city and country Australia. There were big swings to Labor and the Greens in the capital cities, and the election of several new Green MPs has been labelled a green slide, and it also saw South Australians vote in a second Greens senator in Barbara Pocock. She is originally from the Riverlands. Matt Stevens caught up with the newly elected senator.
Well, I was born in Berry, would you believe? and my grandfather was Bill Vasey from Barmer, and I'm really proud of my connection to the Riverland. But while my mum grew up there, I grew up in Lamoureux.
Right.
She married a Mallee farmer, and I grew up on a farm, a wheat and sheep farm, about 10 kilometres outside Lamoureux. So very proud daughter of the Mallee, and, you know, everyone who's listening who's grown up in an agricultural background will know all the gifts that gives you and the challenges, of course. Yeah.
So safe to say you're no stranger to this particular area?
No. I learnt to do the dog paddle in Lake Bonnie, and I still regularly visit the Riverland. I came up there late last year and had the great delight of being shown around by the Renmark Irrigation people who were, you know, took us out and showed us that what's going on around the town of Renmark. And I'm really looking forward to continuing that connection in the years ahead as a senator.
I mentioned before that you've lived, you know, and then you said you lived in Lamoureux, which is right in Barker territory, which at the 2019 election, 81.9% of the votes cast at the local polling booth were in favour of Liberal. So that was in two-party preferred. So how did you end up aligning politically with the Greens?
Yeah, well, I do come from a long line of Liberal voters, no doubt. But, you know, in my family, it was all about being part of it. My parents were strong believers that people got the government they deserved. So engaging, being part of a local government, state or federal, was important. And, you know, I left the farm, my late teens, and went off to study. I worked in shearing sheds and on farms for a couple of years, mm-hmm. then studied economics and found myself working in the Reserve Bank. And then in many other different jobs in the last sort of 20 years, I've been involved in universities studying the labour market. I'm an economist. And so, you know, my politics are pretty different to my parents, but I'm pretty confident, and they're no longer with us, but they would be, I think, proud that I was standing up for what I believed in. And I am very concerned about future generations. And I really feel that the science, I'm a social scientist and I pay a lot of attention to the science, and they're very clear and unanimous that we need to take strong action to preserve our planet. And that's what I'm really motivated for, that the crisis in our environment and in our climate, and the crisis in inequality in our country. I mean, you know, the towns through the Riverland, down in Mount Gambier, across our regional state, there's a crisis in housing, for example, which is really affecting many, many South Australians, and that's a real concern for me. So it's not just the climate issues, but it's certainly a lot about that and a lot about the inequality around us, Matt.
What do you make of the results across the country and even in South Australia, for that matter? Was this election that you felt was the time that there would be more support for a Greens candidate?
Well, you know, I've spent a lot of time, hours and hours and hours, on booths in the last several weeks and in the state election as well. And, you know, person after person came up to me. I was, you know, identifiable Greens candidate, and said they were concerned about the climate and about 10 years of lost time for action. And, you know, they had previously, a number of them said, never voted Green. Many of them had never voted Labor before. They were Liberal voters, but worried about their grandkids, and many young people who are over the two-party system and very disappointed with the failure to take action. So I felt like there was a wave out there of discontent, and it flowed through into that quite a sizable swing to the Greens in South Australia, and a real mandate for action on climate. And I think that's what the next parliament really will be about. And it's no longer a conversation about should we take action or arguing about whether it's happening. It's now going to be a conversation about what do we need to do. And, of course, that extends to the question of our River Murray. How do we keep that river healthy? How do we negotiate a new Murray-Darling Basin plan? That'll be the job of the next parliament. So a lot of very important challenges around climate and environment coming at us.
But I do want to just go to some comments that were made by Greens Senator Sarah Hanson-Young. She's calling for a water minister to be from South Australia. Why is that important to the Greens?
Well, it's very important that we have strong advocacy for our end of the river. Rivers die from the mouth up, and we need to have someone advocating for the river in our parliament and certainly in government who really understands our end of the river mouth, all of the complexity, the ecology, the biodiversity around it, and the people whose livings are made from it, but also the flows that we need for a healthy river system in our state. And so I think it's a really important thing. You know, the river has not been well served by people up the river, well up into Queensland and northern New South Wales, who have not managed it well for the generations to come. And I think the call for a South Australian representation around our river in our parliament and our government's a very important thing. We've got some, you know, really good South Australians heading into our parliament. I'd love to see that strong South Australian advocacy for our river system.
Greens Senator Barbara Pocock speaking with Matt Stevens. It is 17 minutes to one.
You're listening to Cassie Huff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Breaking news now, and Premier Peter Malinauskas is standing up at a press conference as we speak. He said today that it will be the end of the emergency declaration for South Australia, and Grant Stevens will step out of the role as state coordinator. He's been in the role since the start of the pandemic in March 2020, and here's what Premier Peter Malinauskas said a short time ago.
I can advise the people of South Australia that as of only a few minutes ago, the emergency declaration in the state of South Australia has ended. The emergency declaration under the Emergency Management Act concluded only a few moments ago when Commissioner Grant Stevens signed a revocation of that declaration under the Act. That was immediately following an Executive Council meeting hosted, of course, by Her Excellency Frances Adamson, who provided assent to the legislation that made amendments to the Public Health Act early or last week during the course of Parliament. This is a historic moment. This is a significant day when it comes to the management of the COVID-19 pandemic. In South Australia, we have been under an emergency management declaration for 793 days. But today, that has concluded. There have only been approximately 5 emergency management declarations since the inception of the Emergency Management Act some years ago. Never before have we seen a declaration this long. In fact, I understand it that the longest, apart from this one, was for a period of 11 days. It would have been incomprehensible only a few years ago that we would have had a over 700-day emergency declaration, yet that's what has occurred as a result of COVID, and today that has ended. This is an important milestone, but it's also a very important opportunity to acknowledge the extraordinary work that has been undertaken by a handful of South Australians in the management of the pandemic up until this point. I do want to take this opportunity to acknowledge the work of former Premier Stephen Marshall. Of course, we want to acknowledge the extraordinary effort and the ongoing leadership of Professor Nicola Spirier. But today is a particularly important opportunity to acknowledge the work of Commissioner Grant Stevens. I'm not too sure if there are many other places in the world where we would have seen a police commissioner take up such extraordinary responsibility away from traditional decision-making processes as well as Grant Stevens has. You know, here in South Australia, we have seen the South Australian Police Force, led by Grant Stevens, really step up to the plate when it's come to the management of COVID, along with other agencies. But I'm not too sure if South Australians fully comprehend the level of power and authority that is invested in the state coordinator when an emergency declaration occurs. Those powers are extraordinary. They give the police commissioner the ability to do things that would otherwise be somewhat incomprehensible. But we hand over that authority in an emergency because we have absolute confidence in the police commissioner to use those powers and those authorities wisely. And Grant Stevens has done exactly that.
That was Premier Peter Malinauskas a short time ago speaking after the emergency management meeting that they have, and as he has announced there, Grant Stevens will step out of the role as state coordinator. For more information on this, keep listening to ABC Local Radio. Sonia Feldoff will be addressing more of this on her program at 1 o'clock for city listeners and 1:30 for regional listeners. He has also, Premier Malinauskas has also just added that the broad mask mandates in schools will be lifted at the end of this week as well. So a bit of change there. It's been 2 years with a lot of changes. So perhaps maybe things are turning the tide. But keep listening to ABC Local Radio for more information on that. It is 13 minutes to one.
You're listening to Cassie Huff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Now to food. It was certainly a feature of this time, the availability, and now the cost of it has really been forefront of many people's minds, and it seems the world's food supply is running short, and one analyst believes governments will fall before it gets better. With major grain exporting nations at war with each other and a shrinking global cattle herd, concerns are rising about food security. Brett Stewart, president of Global AgriTrends, a firm that consults with food companies and reports on market movements, says everyone is taking notice.
We're watching that very closely, you know, and it all started work with COVID. And not just COVID, but the trillions of dollars that was poured in stimulus around the world. In the U.S. alone, we increased the U.S. money supply 40% in 2 years. And that was over $6 trillion stimulus. And so the big wave of inflation around the world really began with COVID. Consumers began buying, spending money, overloaded demand, overloaded supply chain. Sick workers slowed down production, slowed down logistics. Then we fast forward into 2022 and we see the Russian invasion of the Ukraine, potentially jeopardizing one-fourth of the global wheat export. The Ukraine is the number four corn exporter in the world. And the commodity markets just continue to rise on concerns of potential scarcity. And so around the world, we're already seeing signs of impending social instability. We expect to see governments turn over before this is done. Particularly, the risk lies in, the Middle East, North Africa, Central Africa, those nations that are heavily dependent on imported food face some serious, serious problems now.
You quite literally expect governments to change over the fact that there isn't a lot of available food in the marketplace.
Yeah, and we're actually seeing some of these countries take some strict policy action. India had talked about banning their wheat exports. Just this week, both Brazil and Mexico lifted import tariffs on a whole raft of food items. You can see the nervousness out there in the market, and it is it's quite unsettling.
How long does this go on for? Does it last as long as the war in Ukraine lasts, or is that too simplistic?
Well, that's a good question, and the world crop supply runs on a crop year. If we have these high prices, the expectation is we will produce more next year. The problem is, Warwick, is we not only have a shortage of crops, we potentially have shortages of fertilizer, which are the key input to creating more crops. With the La Nina pattern still intact in the Pacific, there's still risk of drought concerns into mid-year in North America with the grain supply, as well as South America.
What are you watching then? What are the factors at play that you are keeping an eye on?
Well, we're just watching very closely the global food indices to see where those prices move. We're watching very closely to see policy actions around the world that can further disrupt food supplies and trade. You know, it's not just the grain market. We're in a unique spot here, Warwick, where even in the protein space, we're coming into 2022 with fewer global cows in the world than we had a year ago. We have a smaller cow herd. We have a smaller swine herd than we had a year ago. And it's good news for producers because they have a chance here at keeping pace with inflation.
Why is that? Why do we have a smaller cow and swine herd?
It's complicated. Now, one of the major factors, especially for South America, has been Chinese demand. Strong Chinese demand has led to record prices across South America, which has prompted them to slaughter their females more aggressively. And so they're now into a situation where they have shrunk their breeding herd as they slaughter aggressively for China.
Can you go through what the U.S. situation looks like?
Yeah, sure. We've still got significant drought across the Midwest, especially the western half of the country. Hay prices are very short and very tight. And so, again, input costs are high. Producers would like to expand, but when there's no forage or feed, there is simply no option to expand. And so we expect that we'll see this U.S. cow herd down potentially 4% this year in the next inventory report in July. That decline in U.S. beef production for 2023 is the largest decline in 44 years out of America. One thing I didn't mention, we talked about the global food indices, Warwick, is global beef prices are at all-time record highs, and every month they keep going higher. So we're in a spot where the world is short on beef. Prices are absolutely fantastic. Every nation on earth is in decline except Australia, which is the lone country in a rebuild situation.
Brett Stewart, President of Global AgriTrends, speaking with Warwick Long. And while we're talking about food security, that was a bit of a look at what's happening globally. But It's also being seen in Australia, I should say. Organic production sometimes is more affected in these situations as well. And Australia's 2021 Organic Farmer of the Year fears that there could be widespread fruit and vegetable shortages as well as a result of the months of rainy days and flooding across southeast Queensland. McDan says that on top of crop losses, plantings have also been set back by the lack of sun, telling Jennifer Nichols he can't remember a tougher year in business.
Yeah, we're certainly learning new ways of measuring rain. In terms of metres, we've had nearly 1.5 metres of rain on our farms there at Woombye. You know, that 1.5 metres is year to date, so that's to May. And our average yearly rainfall for that particular region is only about 1.7. So we've nearly had a year's supply of rain in half a year.
It's incredible, isn't it? Have you ever seen this much rain in your history of farming here?
I've seen a lot of rain and we've had floods before, but it's about the number of rain days. When you're farming, you really want, you know, good sunny long days where vegetables can just grow all day because they've got sunlight all day. And unfortunately, you know, for the last couple of months, there's just been so many cloudy, wet days linked together. What that means for us farmers is that everything slows down. What we thought would grow in, you know, 10 weeks takes up to 15, 16 weeks. And then, of course, you run the risk then of disease and pests and things like that. So, yeah, it's tough going.
Have you had many fungal disease problems as a result of this rain, especially farming organically?
We're battling on at the moment. It'll be when the sun does come back out and we get a little bit of heat happening again, that's when we'll start to see a lot of fungal disease, lots of mildew. The zucchinis are certainly copping a hiding on the mildew. And, you know, we've got a heap of broccoli in this year, and I'm just really worried about what's going to happen with that if we don't see any big, long, sunny autumn days.
What crops have struggled the most with the heavy rainfall?
Oh, definitely our market greens, so our lettuce and our salad mixes, our spinach, you know, those are crops that are delicate. And when you get, you know, upwards of 200 mil of rain in a day, they tend to fall over and, yeah, basically melt really under the force of the rain.
And are you finding that the rain is also impacting the number of people who make it out to farmers markets?
Yeah, absolutely, Jen. This weekend in particular, we probably only saw half the amount of customers that would normally come out on a weekend to the farmers markets. And so it's kind of a double whammy for us at the moment because the farm's suffering and obviously our sales are suffering at the same time at the markets. So, I can't remember a time when things were this tough. You know, the customers at the markets and also our weekly box customers, we couldn't do what we do without their support. And it's this time that we really need their support. And, yeah, we're just so grateful for them.
Because you've been growing over the years too. How many farms do you actually have at the moment? And then you get supplies from other farmers as well.
Yeah, so we've got three farms that we run of our own. And one of them is a majority of our leafy greens, and so it suffered fairly badly. Our strawberry farm is hurting a lot. We really should have been harvesting lots and lots of strawberries at this point in time, and unfortunately because of the rain we've hardly had a harvest of strawberries at all.
Have you had any problems with flooding?
In the rain at the end of February, we had a lot of problem with flooding. Our second farm there at Woombye was underwater for most of a week. And then just recently as well, in the deluge last week, it went under again. But luckily, we'd only planted the high ground, so none of the low ground.
And what are some of your farming friends telling you too?
Well, I was talking to a few of my mates on the weekend, farming friends, and this is our main growing season now, and we should have nearly finished planting for the whole season, but we're so far behind because of all the wet weather. I think everyone's just in the same boat in that we don't really know how much we're going to be able to harvest this year. you know, it's not just the coast where this is affecting, it's quite Queensland-wide. I know mates of mine in the Lockyer Valley and, you know, in Toowoomba, and, you know, they're in the same boat as we are, and they're equally haven't been able to plant their usual numbers for the year. And I just think that there could be some serious food shortages over the coming 3 or 4 months. As soon as the Victorian harvests are finished, which is sort of, you know, over the next sort of 3 to 4 weeks, the Victorian harvest will finish, and that's when they rely on the Queensland harvest to really kick in. And I think they're just not going to be there because of all the gaps in the rain and the planting.
Good Harvest Organics' Mick Dan, who was named 2021 Organic Farmer of the Year. Certainly some concerns there. It's been very wet. It's not just the flooding that has caused the problems, as he was saying, just the ability to plant and get crops up as well is causing an issue. Well, we've had a couple of questions come in on the changes to the emergency declaration in South Australia. Sonia Feldoff will be on your radio next, and I'm sure she'll be able to address some of these questions.
We will indeed. In fact, we'll bring you more of that press conference, which should be addressing that. Obviously, big changes that have been foreshadowed, just announced. So we'll unpack some of that, get some of your reaction. Feel free to give us a ring about how you think that might impact you or some of the questions you might be having. And also, in terms of the federal election, we're going to take a look at climate change today, because it was obvious you voted for climate change when you see the campaign or the candidates that were run and the Greens rise. So where do we start?
More to come on your ABC local radio. It's coming up to 1 o'clock.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.